It is my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Esther Adler from St. Paul. She is the Associate Chaplain of Jewish Life at Hamline University and also Associate Rabbi at Mount Sinai in St. Paul.
Zion, Mount Zion Temple.
I knew I was going to say Mount Zion, but St. Paul,
Paul
is correct.
Yes.
I know it's Minnesota, but sometimes I get mixed up with the Minneapolis St. Paul. So thank you, Esther, and Esther's going to share with us information on Judaism 101. Thank you.
So I never really know, I don't know the knowledge level of the people I'm talking to, so forgive me if this is 101 and you're at 201 or 1001 or whatever. Sometimes I ask, all right, I'll ask. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is I could have been a rabbi, and 1 is Judah what? Hold up your hand. Well, if you're between 1 and 5, raise your hand. Okay, if you're between 5 and 10, raise your hand. Raise them high. Come on, be proud of it. There you go. Good. All right. So I'm going to speak mostly around 3, 4, 5, and 2 ones. You'll forgive me I don't mean to condescend at all, ever. So, and the other thing is, I encourage you to ask questions. You can interrupt me with a question, and I want to leave a lot of time for questions. I believe with all my heart that there is no such thing as a stupid question. All questions are good. That's the best way to learn. And I suspect if you ask a question that you think is a stupid question, someone on the other side of the room is going to go, oh, thank God. They asked it instead of me. So please, don't be shy about asking any questions, even if you fear it might be a stupid question. It's not. Judaism really is a religion of questioning, and we have a long tradition of questioning our own tradition and just asking questions, questions, questions all the time. If you've ever seen Fiddler on the Roof, you see Tevye is always questioning God, and that arises out. I mean, it's a funny Broadway movie kind of thing, but it really arises from deep in the tradition. It's hard to know what the 101 is of a 3,000, 5,000-year-old tradition. So I'm just going to kind of start with some basics that I think are important, and again, encourage you, please, don't mind interrupting and ask questions. And I'm tangled in my necklace here. If I'm asked to boil down Judaism into, what's the most important principle, it's a very hard thing to do. But I would probably come around to the notion of covenant, in Hebrew, brit. In the Hebrew scriptures, there's a developing covenant between God and, as I said at some point yesterday, the patriarchs, Abraham, and then over the course of time through Moses, when he's up on Mount Sinai, the Israelites are all gathered below, and they enter into a group covenant with God, as it were. Moses offers them the Ten Commandments, which is really symbolic for a body of Jewish law, of expectations that God expects of the people. In return, God's promising the people some things, and the people respond in Hebrew, Na'aseh v'nishma. Translation is always a fuzzy issue. I could go on about that for hours. Translation, 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 they say. Na'aseh v'nishma can be translated, we will do and we will listen. But nishma, shema, David was talking about yesterday at the Living Word, what did he call it? Auditory theology?
Acoustic.
No. Acoustic, yes. This notion of listening also implies understanding. So Judaism is all about doing and seeking to understand or seeking to deepen our understanding. So back to covenant. This notion of covenant as I understand it, brit. Covenant is a fancy word for contract. Relationship. We're in a contractual relationship with God, and that can be understood in many different ways, but in general, a contract implies that I have responsibilities and you have responsibilities, and we both have to keep our side of the bargain. And it's very much based on trust and relationship. So Judaism is a religion based on, I think, relationship with God and relationship with other people. And it is not so much based on faith. And I think this is possibly, I don't want to say a fundamental difference, but a conceptual difference, perhaps, between Judaism and some of Christianity. And forgive me if I generalize about Christianity. I know there are many Christianities. And I can't really generalize about Judaism either, even though that's what I'm standing here doing. But nothing I say is absolute and applies to everything and everybody, so that's kind of a caveat. A difference, I think, a conceptual philosophical difference between Judaism and Christianity, and perhaps Islam too, I know less about that, is that Judaism is pretty light on doctrine. We don't have a lot of doctrine. Doctrine being, as I understand it, this is what you must believe to be within the bounds, within the group. Doctrine, as I understand it, is the things you believe. The things you must believe, the faith assertions. Judaism basically has one or two. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, Deuteronomy 6. There's our doctrine for you. Beyond that, it's all kind of, it depends. And I mentioned yesterday, all my students that I've ever taught know that my answer to most questions of belief are, it depends. Because it depends who you ask, because we're not told in our texts, this is what you are to believe about X, Y, or Z, the big questions of life. We're told what to do about the big questions of life. When someone dies, we know we have exactly what to do. And from out of the ritual or the precepts of what to do, we draw our understanding of what's behind the what to do. And hence the big move to question and dig and always understand, because we're told you do this, and then you do this, and you do this, and you do this. And then we spend our time thinking and discussing, well, why do we do that? What does that mean? And that's kind of where we spend our time, but there are no final answers to those things. So light on doctrine, very little you must believe this to be within. Heavier on, you could call it ritual or you could call it behavioral. It's kind of both. So there's less prescription on what to believe and more prescription on what to do, both ritually and ethically. And sometimes people say one is a religion of creed and one is a religion of deed. I think that's a mistake. It's too much of a blanket. It's too black and white. It suggests that the religion of creed doesn't care about deed, and the religion of deed doesn't care about creed. I forget that. Of course, Christianity, of course, Islam, of course, I think every legitimate religion, and by legitimate, I mean a religion that doesn't seek to hurt anybody or kill anybody, wants us to be good. I think that all our religions want us to be good. But as far as kind of the fundamental driving principles, Judaism is more about what we do. But there's the nishma part, there's the understand part. We do it, but we also seek to understand why we're doing it. And that's where we kind of seek out spirituality and meaning. I'm going to pause there for a second and just do a little bit of vocabulary lesson. And forgive me if this is obvious to anyone, but I think it's really important. There's some terminology. I mentioned yesterday, I think that we live in a Christian country. United States claims to be secular separation of church and state, but right there, when we're separating church and state,
church.
We're not separating mosque and state, we're not separating. Our vocabulary, our frame of reference, our language in the United States of America is Christian. And that's fine. And I'm getting off topic, but this is one of my little soapboxes. I'll just hop up here. I think that we are misguided to think we live in a completely secular culture. I think that the majority of America is Christian. And so Christianity kind of informs our culture. It informs our language. When the three of us get together tonight to do another interfaith dialogue thing, I'll talk more about that in regards to sin. But some language things that I think are kind of important. When we're in multi-faith settings or in secular settings like the academy, the university, the school, there's some terms that I prefer to see used. And again, forgive me, I don't mean to condescend, but I think a lot of people aren't often exposed. When I talk about dates in time, I'm going to use as a delineation the terms. I'm not going to use the terms BC and AD. Those are the common terms that we use in America. BC standing for, everybody knows,
Before Christ.
AD, sometimes people get confused. It's not after death that some people think it's, and correct my Latin, please. I hear laughter, so some of you know this, but don't be embarrassed if you don't. Anno Domini, is my Latin correct? So these, and here is Jesus, right? Birth.
Zero.
Or zero.
Or
one.
Yeah, one.
But what you may or may not know is these are highly theological terms. These are theological assertions, not just points in time. And this is where I go to America and maybe even the whole Western world lives in a Christian perspective. Before Christ, Christ is not his last name. Christ is his title. And please forgive me if I'm... Christ is the Greek for Mashiach, which is the Hebrew. Well, Messiah is the English for the Hebrew Mashiach. The Greek Christ means the anointed one. And everything else the concept of Messiah brings, the one who's going to do stuff in the future or the past. So asserting that this moment is before the birth of the Messiah, if I say something happened in 25 BC, I'm making a Christian theological assertion that doesn't apply to me, and I'll get to that in a minute. So in Jewish settings, and I think secular settings, we use the term BCE, which stands for before the common era or before the Christian era, which is just descriptive of a point in time rather than a theological assertion. Same for Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. I will get to in a minute the theology of Jesus for Jews. But he's not, by Jews, he's not considered the Lord. So we use the term CE within the common era or the Christian era. So when I talk about dates, these are the terms I will use.
Have those been common terms in the Jewish tradition for a long time?
I think so.
Become more common now.
Yeah, is it common in the world you all live in?
Yeah.
Good, because when I talk to younger people, sometimes if I talk to college classes, and even in churches, you know, at the fellowship when I'm asked to speak, some folks don't know this. So you're a more educated crowd. The other set of terms I like to use, instead of Old Testament and New Testament, I like to use Hebrew scriptures and Christian scriptures, because once again, excuse me, those terms are descriptive as opposed to assertions about new and improved, old, yeah. Old and worn out. The Hebrew scriptures were written in Hebrew. And I like to use the term Christian scriptures until someone gives me a better descriptive term. Okay, so just some words about language. So Judaism and Christianity share many, many things. Some of our liturgies are the same. I would argue that you borrowed it from us, but chronologically it's probably true. But we do share many things. Sunday night in, I think it was in the Eucharist liturgy, you said, Sanctus.
Lights
on red now.
No,
should it be red? It seems like it should be green.
Yeah.
Can I just talk? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
We've got it. Yes, that's a yes. Okay.
It just won't be recorded.
Oh, good.
No, that's not good. That's not good.
Recordings make me nervous.
My synagogue started live streaming all of our services. So you got to be careful what you whisper to the cantor on the side. You know? where was I? So we share a lot of things. Sanctus, sanctus, sanctus. Holy, holy, holy is one of our central prayers too. Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. Adonai Tzvaot. Same exact words. We say them in Hebrew. You say them in Greek, Latin. But I suspect they mean very different things when you hear them than when I hear them. And that brings us to, well, we may share some of the words. We may interpret them very, very differently. So we can't assume that, even though we're sharing those words, that they mean the same thing to all of us. Case in point, and again, this melds with the idea of translation and how powerful translation is. All of our sacred texts were written in a different language originally. And in most Christian Bibles, or at least in the older Christian Bibles, the Old Testament that you read, the Hebrew scriptures that you're reading, are very often an English translation of a, if you're lucky, an English translation of a Greek translation of the Hebrew. Sometimes it's an English translation of a German translation of a Latin translation of the Greek translation of the Hebrew. If you've ever played telephone, you know what can happen. But even if you're not playing telephone, any word in one language can be translated sometimes into five words in another, or five words in one language can be translated as one in another. Snow, right? Even in Minnesota, we pretty much only have one word for snow. And it's there all the time. But in Inuit languages, or in languages of the far north, Eskimo languages, they've got different words to describe different kinds of snow. So if I'm reading along, or if I speak one of those languages and I'm reading and I see in English the word snow, I have a choice of five words I want to translate it to. And depending on which one I pick, I might be describing a devastating blizzard, or I might be describing a pretty little snowfall. And when I translate that text, it's going to make a big difference. So when we're translating the Hebrew text into Greek, then Latin, then German, then English, or even just Hebrew into English, but with a different theological perspective, we're going to get a very different answer. So when we read, and I always forget the verse in Isaiah about a virgin giving birth to a child, is it Isaiah? That word in Hebrew can be translated virgin, but it can be also translated as a young woman. So a young woman gives birth to a child, we say mazel tov, you know, congratulations. it's a miracle. But if a virgin gives birth to a child, it's a whole different kind of miracle. So when a Jew reads that text, we read it as a young woman giving birth to a child as nature would have it. Mm-hmm. When a Christian reads that text, you might read it as a virgin giving birth, and then you've got something out of the natural, ordinary cycle of things. So which brings me around to that guy who was born of either a virgin or a young woman. What is the Jewish view about Jesus? I said last night, and I've said to a couple other people, and it's not meant to offend. If it were not for living among Christians, Jesus would be not part of the Jewish story. He would be irrelevant. He would be one of many, many men who were teaching Judaism, preaching in the Jewish community in that first century of the Common Era. At that time, I mentioned this yesterday, forgive me if I'm repeating myself, there were many different streams of Judaism, many different groups that disagreed about certain fundamental principles. Jewish law, Messiah, the role of the temple, and whether it was corrupt or not, and the end of days, apocalypse. They were all Jews, but they had different views. Like today, you have different kinds of Christians, Methodists, Lutherans, Presbyterians, and so on. We have different kinds of Jews, Reformed, Conservative, Orthodox. Same back then. You had Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, and Jesus' followers, and probably many others. Jesus' teachings got picked up by Paul and then by Constantine and spread, and it became Christianity. Had that not happened, all those other groups kind of fell away, and we don't have Essenes anymore, and we don't really have Sadducees anymore. The priestly cult is gone. What remained from all those groups is the Jesus group, which became Christianity, and the Pharisees, which became Rabbinic Judaism. How'd that happen? In the year 70 of the Common Era, the Romans destroyed Jewish life in Jerusalem. They tried to destroy all the Jews. Some of them survived. As a little aside, you can describe every Jewish holiday in 10 words. I think it's 10. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. So, you think I'm kidding.
No, I know. I know, you're right.
So in the year 70, they tried to kill us, we survived. And a couple of the sages of the time, there's a wonderful story about one hid in a coffin and got carried out of Jerusalem and then started up an academy in the northern part of Israel in the Galilee, also where Jesus was. Reimagined, how can we keep being Jewish when the temple is gone? Because before that, all the Judaism you read about in the Hebrew scriptures, it's not they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. It's they tried to kill us, we survived, let's kill some animals. They worshipped God through an animal sacrificial cult. In the year 70, that went away. And a small fringe number of Jews wants that to come back, but most of us are living in a post-sacrificial, if you will, since 70. Our worship has moved from that sacrificial cult to the synagogue and the house of study. Where was I going with that? I lost my way. So Judaism survived, Christianity survived. Those other groups from the first century have disappeared for one reason or another. The Judaism that survived was recreated, reimagined, reframed by this small group of sages that escaped the destruction in 70. And they reimagined it. How do we continue to live as Jews in the absence of our central institution? I like to think in metaphors. You can imagine your own metaphor. You know, what if, God forbid, now it seems like it could happen. What if on 9/11 they had gotten the Pentagon and the White House? Now, those are the buildings, not the institutions, but it would be kind of hard. Or find a different, better metaphor. But the central grounding institution of Judaism, the way you worship, everything, gone. Judaism could have gone with it, but it didn't because these sages reimagined it. How did they reimagine it? They took the laws that had been given and tried to apply them, learn to apply them, creatively applied them in a post-sacrificial temple cult era. We still use the word temple today, but it's not meaning the temple in Jerusalem, which was destroyed in 70. And when they reframed it as a legal system, a system of laws governing every aspect of life, both ritual and practical and civil and legal, because they could do that at the time. There have been a few times in history where Jews were self-governing. Most of the time we've lived under other governments, and so the civil law applies that the government of the place we live in, but ritual law, of course, is unique. So Judaism becomes a system of laws governing every aspect of life, hence we often call it not so much a faith system, but a way of life. And as that develops, eventually in modern times, we get differing views on the role of law in Judaism. First of all, Christianity questioned the role of law and took a different approach to it. But within Judaism, in modern times, groups have emerged with differing views of the role of law. Is it law? Is it guidance? Is it divine? is it human-made? And those have kind of rolled into and developed into the modern movements of Judaism today. We don't call them denominations, we call them movements. It's not that different, but it is a little different. Reform, conservative, orthodoxy. A little bit about that, and then probably I'm going to stop talking and let you ask questions. Before the mid-1800s, Judaism differed by region. You had your Eastern European Jews and your Russian Jews and your German Jews and even one little village to the next. So the differences were more cultural and regional. In the mid-1800s in Germany, some of the rabbis started making more ideological changes and aesthetic changes that were not regional but out of principle. And they started, they were influenced by rationalism and the German Enlightenment and started bringing more of a rational approach. A whole lot of other things as well. That's a whole other talk. But Reform Judaism emerged in the mid to late 1800s in Germany as a response to the cultural changes of the times. Then it came to America. At some point, some of those reformers said, whoa, you've gone too far. You're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Slow down the train. And they became the conservative movement. So first you just had Judaism with regional differences. Then you had a reform movement. Conservative kind of slowed it back. And only then did you develop an orthodox movement, which kind of tried to keep with the notions. What are the differences today between the movements has to do primarily with the role of law, as I said. Orthodox Judaism would argue, at least ideologically, it doesn't mean every Jew in an Orthodox congregation really believes it, that Jewish law is divinely given, and so we're to follow it as law. Reform Judaism, when they threw out the baby with the bathwater, said it's not God's law. It's law about how people have dealt with God over time. It's Jewish, but it doesn't have legal authority over us. It doesn't have God's authority over us. It's man-made in a particular time and place from the year 70 and onward, or even in the Old Testament and onward. So we can change it as we need. Conservative Judaism tries to walk a middle ground between we can change it as we need, but we change it within a legal system instead of just saying we're changing it because it needs to be changed. That's largely the differences. On the ground, there's cultural differences and liturgical differences, but largely it has to do with the authority of Jewish law in your life. Back to theology and Jesus and God. just a word about my own personal theology. So as I said, Jesus as the Son of God, as the Messiah, or even as a prophet, as in Islam, or as an important preacher, really is not within the Jewish mindset. And it's only important that a Jew know about Jesus because we live among Christians. And it's important to know about our neighbors. Just as important, we need to know about Muslims and Buddhists and everyone else. But the majority of our neighbors are Christians, so we know about Jesus. And we care because we care about you. But he's not to us God. And theologically, the notion of Jesus as the Son of God, in Judaism, every human being is equally a child of God in the divine image. But no human being ever was, or perhaps will be, more a child of God in any way than any other human being. And that's an important, I think, theological difference between Judaism and some parts of Christianity, at least. And as far as Messiah goes, someone asked about that last night, or whenever that was. I feel like I've been here forever. Different Jews have very different views of Messiah, everything from a very traditionalist view of praying for an individual Messiah who's a descendant of David to come riding into Jerusalem on a white donkey. Other things will happen too. On the other end of the perspective are those who don't believe in an individual Messiah coming, but that what we hope and pray for is that we will keep repairing the world and working on it and working on it till it gets to be messianic in that all will be well. Everybody will get along, peace, harmony, and goodwill. But we bring it. We got to work on it. We got to keep doing it. And everything in between. So Messiah is an example of where we don't have specific doctrine. You have to believe this to be within the fold. There are boundaries to what we believe to be within the fold. You believe in Jesus as a central figure or the Son of God or the Messiah. In my view, that puts you outside mainstream Judaism into Christianity. There are those people who call themselves Jews for Jesus, Messianic Jews, or Hebrew Christians. And from the perspective of mainstream Judaism, I would argue that those people are Christians practicing Judaism rather than Jewish, any of those other titles. To me, they're not Jews. They're Christians practicing Jewish practices, from my perspective. Okay. One more thing. I keep saying that, don't I? How we treat Scripture. Because we're not as quite so doctrinal, you must believe this to be within the fold, how we approach Scripture is very multivocal. And again, it's the difference between what you need to believe versus what you need to do. There are streams of Judaism, the more traditional streams of Judaism, which will argue there are absolute rights and wrongs regarding what you need to do. You need to light the Sabbath candles by 18 minutes after sundown. But what you believe about God and the Sabbath and life and death, again, that's open for discussion. But what time you light the candles is important. That's extreme, but it's kind of the difference in the model. We know exactly, we have written how to bury our dead, how to welcome a new baby into the world ritually, how to celebrate the Sabbath or this holiday or that holiday. But we don't have a lot of absolute doctrine on where did we come from before we were born, where do we go after we're dead, what's the deeper meanings behind things. Those we are encouraged to discuss and grapple with. And there aren't any absolute right or wrong answers. So generally, the answer to any question of what do Jews believe or how do we read this scripture is always going to be multivocal. Has boundaries. It's not anything goes. I'll be clear about that, especially I'm told I keep plugging my own sessions, but I'm going to plug another session. My next sessions are going to be how Jews interpret Scripture. And it's multivocal. It's not anything goes, and there are boundaries. But for any question, there are usually multiple answers, and they're both going to be right. This goes back to now Fiddler on the Roof, where there's a funny line, but it's really deeply Jewish. Where they're having an argument in the tavern, and one of the guys says it's this, and another guy, and the rabbi says you're right. And then the other guy says it's that, and the rabbi says you're right. And a third guy says, but rabbi, how can they both be right? And the rabbi says,
you're right.
You're right too. And it seems impossible, perhaps, but in Jewish interpretation of Scripture, especially the narrative portions, and the more philosophical portions, multiple interpretations sit right on the page next to each other, and they may be completely contradictory, and they can both be right. And that's a whole different mindset, and for some people it just busts their head right open and they can't stand it, and other people just love that it's so open-ended. And that leads me to something I wasn't asked about, but I've been musing about, and if I was a different person, I'd go and get a PhD in this. I think that like we are born, and this has been studied, with personality temperaments. I'm an introvert. Some of you are extroverts. I think we're born with spiritual temperaments, which leads us to feel at home in different types of traditions. One person will feel very at home in a Buddhist mindfulness kind of tradition without a lot of heavy doctrine, without a lot of heavy ritual defined like Judaism has. Another person will feel at sea in there, where that person would feel in prison in a highly ritualized or highly doctrinal. And I think that we're born with that. And if we're lucky, we're born into a tradition that suits our temperament. And if we're born into a tradition or a household that doesn't suit our temperament, sometimes we go out seeking and find it somewhere else. Worst case scenario, we have crises and don't come out of it okay. But I have found that when people are seeking something different than what they were born with or born into, I think it has to do with, I think it's hardwired, but that's just me and I have no proof of it. I'm going to stop talking. Please, questions? Yes.
Would you speak about the origins of different ideas about life after death or what happens after death in the Jewish tradition?
Yeah, that's one of those it depends questions. And you're going to have Jews who run the gamut of that there is some kind of life. There is in our textual. We get all of our notions from the various texts, most of which are either interpretive or legal, but they're not doctrinal, once again. It's not a rabbi writing a doctrine on life after death. It's kind of hidden in discussions of other things. But there are people who believe in something called Olam Haba, the world to come. That there is something called the world to come, and the righteous have a place waiting for them in the world to come. What's it like there? There's not a lot of clear writing. It's left up to our imaginations. But it's there for the righteous. That's where they go. And so that's kind of a sense of there is something beyond this world. There's this world. There's the world to come. There are notions dealing with, you know, why do the righteous suffer? Some people will believe, some of our texts say, if you're suffering in this world, but in the next world, if you're righteous, then your reward is being saved for you then. On the other end of the spectrum is my father, who is a Jew, who says, he's 97 years old, Kinahora, just had a birthday. But he says, when it's over, put me in a glad bag on the curb. He actually says that, but I'm not going to do it. Two very different ends of the spectrum. And lots of things in between. What do I believe personally?
And what do you think most Jews? You haven't taken a poll?
It depends who you ask. It might sort of cluster in an Orthodox community, might be a little one way in a very liberal community, but you'd have to ask every individual Jew, and they might give you two opinions themselves, because we're not told that. We're not given answers to those questions. Which again, for some people, that's the right religious approach, because nobody's ever come back and told us. For other people, I want answers. Don't give me a we don't know. That's not comforting. But for Jews, I think not knowing is a more comfortable place than perhaps for some others.
So do any Jews have near-death experiences?
Jews have had near-death experiences, and they describe them. But each person's experience is going to be seen as their experience, as opposed to, I think, interpreted through a given theological lens.
Do they all see bright lights? Or?
I haven't discussed it with that many or read that many reports, so I'm sure people have written about it. Just one word about my own personal theology, that I think there is something about the soul that is eternal. I don't know that I'm going to come back as a grasshopper, but I think that somehow my soul is going to recycle into something or someone, or it's very vague, but that's kind of my gut feeling. There is a notion in Jewish law called teku, which is an acronym, the first letters which make a word, of when Elijah comes back and tells us, then we'll know. But for now, we don't know, and we're, again, comfortable in the not knowing.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I appreciate the what appears to me, of my very limited understanding of Judaism, the being okay with the mystery, like the just living in the unknown and not having to figure it all out at every... Although the intellectual dialogue is very rich. Mm-hmm. And I also appreciate, what I'm thinking is how I'm interpreting the difference between doctrine and what was the other word you used?
Non-doctrine. practice?
Like,
I don't know. Behavior?
Oh, I know what I know.
I
sorry.
Have a good word
like
for
lighting
it.
The candle 18 minutes later, but having that be really necessary. I think to me that speaks of bringing order to chaos. Mm-hmm. Like we can only have so much mystery. We can only have so much chaos.
That's
and
true.
Then we need to kind of rein it in and feel safe.
Yes.
And so to me, saying 18 minutes is not a bad thing. It's like, oh, we're just trying to be... have some kind of boundaries. That
I think that's
open.
A really good point. Judaism is very much a religion of boundaries. Mm-hmm. Jacob Neusner writes about that, I think. And all these laws, I think, are a way to answer the big questions by controlling what we can control and saying, well, there are things we can't control and we don't know, but we'll control all these things in a really clear way.
Yeah.
Reform Judaism said maybe that's a little too binding, and so we're going to open it back out a little bit. Yes. The lady in blue in the back had a question.
So,
everyone's in blue.
You talked about the covenant with God, and the Jews are to follow the law as it's interpreted, you know, in that time and place. And so in Christianity, we have the promise of salvation as kind of the, maybe kind of our covenant of faith. So what is God, and you said that it's a covenant between God and the people, so if the people follow the law, their part, and what is God's promise to?
Once again, that depends. It's going to depend who you ask. it's not so much what we think about. These are questions, I think, that are, again, culturally conditioned by Christianity. And it's just not a front burner question for Jews. We are concerned with how are we living here and now. For some Jews, it's how am I living, how well am I following the ritual laws and the ethical laws. And for other Jews, it's how well am I living up to the way I understand God and Judaism wants me to live in the world and be good and ethical and less ritual in a spectrum. But we're not asking the question of salvation. Again, salvation also is a very... Christian conditioned question that Jews just don't tend to concern ourselves. I think one reason is, and we'll get to it tonight, we're going to talk about sin and forgiveness, right, in the trialogue. We don't believe in original sin as something that we need to be cleansed of or rescued from or saved from. So we don't really need to be, salvation, as I understand, means saving. We don't believe there's anything we need to be saved from. We believe that we need to live as well as we can in the world while we're here. If there's something beyond, the righteous are going to get in, and the people who mess up a lot, if they repent, they'll get in too. We don't really have a notion of where are those folks going to go. We don't have a bifurcation of the good go to heaven, the bad go to hell. I'll talk more about what we believe about sin and forgiveness later. So salvation isn't something we need, essentially. And so it's not something it's not a front burner issue.
Yeah, and
it's not even really, we do have the term in Hebrew, Yeshua, but... it's a different, it's more of a communal thing of the whole people, not individually.
I was kind of thinking, I didn't expect that there was the concept of salvation, but I was kind of wondering more about like the idea of the Holy Land of Israel, if that was considered part of the covenant.
Yes, I mean, when you get to talking about geography and promise, then it gets very political and yucky. It's a theological term. And I don't really want to go there, but there are Jews who believe, I'm not one of them, that God promised greater Israel to the Jews and everyone else better get out. I don't agree. My cousin believes that, and we had a very uncomfortable lunch at her house when we were in Jerusalem recently, because I don't agree with that. And even if it was true, it's not helpful. Because that's not the world we live in. There are other Jews who believe that historically there have been Jews in that land for a long time. We also killed a lot of people to get that land. Most of those peoples don't exist anymore. Which brings me to kind of Jewish interpretation of stories, which is one of my other sessions. I struggle with a lot of the stories in the Old Testament, and most of my Jewish co-religionists do as well. There's some really nasty stuff in the Old Testament. But I think the world can be a nasty place, and the way we approach those nasty stories is to struggle with them and say, how can we do it differently? This happened, or maybe it didn't happen, but the story is there. What can we learn from the story? How can we not behave? How can we behave? So yes, Israel is, for most Jews, close to their heart, deeply embedded in our mother's milk, as it were. It's in our tradition. It's in the scriptures. But where we stand theologically and politically about it, wide spectrum. Does that answer the question?
Thank you.
Long answer. Yes.
Are the scriptures of our Old Testament and your, what is it, the Torah or the
yeah.
Bible?
Okay.
Is that identical or?
Very good question. It's the same and it isn't. the Old Testament, and it's not even the same in all Christian scriptures, because
right.
as I understand it, Catholic Bibles have different order of scriptures than Protestant Bibles, than Jewish Old Testament, than Jewish, I'll teach you a Hebrew acronym again, Tanakh. We call what you call the Old Testament Tanakh. In Hebrew, abbreviations are not just like USA, but it's turned into a word with vowels. So T stands for Torah, which is the first five books, and all the Bibles agree on that. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Interesting, four Greek names and one English one. Go figure. The N stands for Nevi'im, which is prophets. In Jewish Bibles versus Catholic versus Protestant, the same prophets are in different orders. So in Jewish Bibles, it tends to go the longer books, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then the shorter books, different orders in the different Bibles. And then the Ch stands for, in Hebrew, Ketuvim, the writings, Psalms, Song of Songs, and those other kinds of books. We group them like that. Other Bibles group them differently, order them differently. They're essentially the same books. And then Catholic Bibles, I believe, have a group of books called the Apocrypha. That's Greek for the outside books. Those were Jewish books that the sages that canonized this in the first century, second century, left out. But they were books that were in Hebrew mostly, some in Greek. Ben Sira, the books of the patriarchs, different things like that. They're not in our Bible, even though they're Jewish stories. They're in Catholic Bibles. Interestingly, our holiday of Hanukkah is from the books of Maccabees, which are not in our Bible. They're in the Catholic Bible. But they were Jewish books describing Jewish stories. Yes?
So that actually leads me to this question. Is there an English translation of all these books that we have in our Old Testament by a Jew rather than...
Oh, yes. Many.
Mm-hmm.
And I always love when I sit around a Torah study or a Bible study table to have as many translations as you can at the table. I have a pretty good command of Hebrew, so I usually know like some of the nuances that a word might have. But it's great fun to have four or five translations around the table, and you can get some very different presentations. So kind of our version of the King James Version, if you will, is the Jewish Publication Society, which came out in that's the publishing house that published a translation, written by committee probably, in the 40s, I think. Then there's the old JPS. Then there's the new JPS, which came out in probably the 70s. A little more modern language, fixed up some things. And then you have several translators who take different perspectives, some trying to stay very true to the idioms. So lech lecha, which in Hebrew kind of sounds onomatopoeic.
Mm-hmm.
This translator will try to kind of replicate that in the English. There are others that try to be true to historical context, others that try to be true to the language, others that try to make it sound like if the Hebrew is flowing and poetic, they'll try to make the English sound flowing and poetic, whereas a direct translation will sound stilted and awkward in English. So there's a lot of translators. There's some standard ones that you find around the table.
Any that you recommend?
NewJPS, Stone, and Fox.
What do you call that? I mean, if you went to the bookstore and said,
I'd like to buy the Old Testament translation by Stone or by Fox. I don't, Everett Fox, maybe? I don't remember Stone's first name. Because when we're sitting around the table, I say, oh, what translation are you reading? And Jules will say, I'm reading the Stone. And so-and-so will say, I'm reading the Fox. So, but if you were to Google it, you know, translations, Jewish translations, English translations, you'll get a variety. If you go to something like the Blue Letter Bible, or there's another one, Bible Gateway, there's like 50 different English translations, you know. It's kind of cool. They're all Christian for the most part, but a whole variety of translations. Yes?
Can you say a few words, please, about the Jewish calendar, and then also as part of that, if you desire, if there are pitfalls that Christians make or things that Christians do that are, even with good intent, offensive around those things?
That's a wonderful question.
Holidays?
About the holidays.
I can answer that.
Huh?
You and I talk about this a lot.
Congregations
who do seders.
Yes,
and
for
think
an example.
They're
the Passover
doing
example.
A good thing.
Okay.
But that may not be what you're...
So, yeah, it's a really good question, and I'll answer the first part first and the second part. The Jewish holiday cycle or calendar cycle is a lunar calendar, which is why the Jewish holidays don't sync up exactly with the Gregorian calendar holidays. So it's a lunar calendar, and there are several holidays that are actually from Scripture, from the what we call the Torah, the first five books. There are other holidays that developed in the years after 70 when they were kind of reconfiguring. Most of our holidays have multiple levels of significance. Most of them have an agricultural connection or a kind of natural world connection, a historical event connection, and a like spiritual, thematic, universal message connection. Almost every Jewish holiday operates on those three levels. Some are biblical, some are post-biblical. And the sensitivities, I think, would be around Passover and Hanukkah. Let's do Hanukkah first because that's easier. Hanukkah falls around Christmas time. So it's actually one of our more minor holidays, biblically. It's about the Book of Maccabees, which didn't even make it into Scripture. But it falls around Christmas, and we live in a Christian world, so it gets beefed up, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It gets troubling when we beef up Hanukkah so much to make it look just like Christmas. Mm-hmm. Christians have Santa Claus. Somebody invents Hanukkah Harry.
No.
Christians have a Christmas tree. Someone invents a Hanukkah bush.
Right.
Those are kind of at the far end. Christians get presents on Christmas. Jews get presents on Hanukkah. That's not original to the holiday, but it's become part of it. So some is within reasonableness. Some feels a little far out. And it crosses a line between acculturation, which means fitting in and borrowing from, we borrow from the majority culture, and totally assimilating, or what's the word?
Appropriating.
Appropriating. Thank you. I have no right to have a Christmas tree in my home because I don't believe in the holiday. I give Christmas presents to my Christian friends, et cetera, et cetera. Which brings us to then Passover. Passover is a very, very important Jewish holiday because it's part of our fundamental story, the liberation of the Israelites from slavery in Egypt, which leads to Mount Sinai. It's a really fundamental part of the story that we're commanded to remember all the time. In fact, every Sabbath, part of the blessing over the wine is remember the Exodus from Egypt. But we remember it ritually in a big ritual on Passover. That's what it celebrates, the liberation of the Israelites from slavery in Egypt. Sometimes, in modern times, I think some Christians, in an effort to maybe understand their Jewish roots, have taken on Passover as their own. I'm trying to be sensitive because many of your churches might do this, but for me as a Jew, it feels like appropriation. I am often asked, will you come lead a Seder in my church? And I have to explain, no, I won't do that. But you are welcome to come to our Seder at my house or at the synagogue and experience Passover as a Jewish holiday. I don't believe Passover is a Christian holiday. Jesus may have been celebrating a Seder meal, but even by the time he was celebrating the Seder meal, he had changed it in keeping with his own philosophy of Judaism, which became Christianity. The way Jesus celebrated the Passover is not the way Jews do it today. The way we do it today follows something that was kind of contemporaneous with him. There's a book called the Mishnah, written down about 200, which kind of documents the conversations from 70 onward of how to rework Judaism. And the Passover Seder, as we practice it today, is pretty much the same as the one described in here. The one you read about in the New Testament will be quite different. And it's a Jesus supper, perhaps, but it's not a Jewish Passover Seder. So that gets complicated, and I'd be happy to talk more. How can Christians not offend in the bigger picture, I think, is to, and I think maybe David raised this in his talk yesterday, don't assume. I think when you're part of the majority culture, you assume that everybody is like you because you are the majority. When you're not part of the majority culture, one becomes very aware of that. And I'm a majority culture in that I am white, even a white woman. But it's become kind of a big hoo-ha about whether you wish someone Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays, right? But if you wish someone Merry Christmas, you're assuming that they're Christian. And we can't assume that. So being careful of our assumptions and asking questions if we're not sure, I think is the best way to go. Yes?
So speaking to that, would you be offended if someone gave you a Christmas gift?
I wouldn't be offended, but it would be more sensitive to give me a Hanukkah gift if you know that I'm Jewish, or to ask, do you celebrate, can I get you something? Mm-hmm. Or even better, what I would like, and this is what, you know, you get to a certain age and you don't need any more crap in your house. So the best gift for me would be make a donation to a worthy cause. But, you know, that's taking it, that's doing a lot of education to someone who just wants to wish me a Merry Christmas. But if I had more guts, I think, maybe the right thing for me to do would be to say, thank you for your gift. I'm Jewish, so I don't really celebrate Christmas, but that was really thoughtful. Maybe I'll donate it, or maybe I wouldn't say that. I don't know, because it's important also, Judaism values greatly not shaming another person. You're not allowed, Jewish law, you're not allowed to make someone's face red. You're not allowed to embarrass or shame someone. So I would have to walk a very careful line, you know, if I'm really being thoughtful, to teach you something without shaming you or embarrassing you. Would I be offended? No. Some Jews would. Some Jews get really bent out of shape at Christmas time. I don't.
But to take it a step farther, say when I had kids in school and they each had 6 teachers and a bus driver, we sent baked goods, in this case 6-inch tall gingerbread cookies, to everyone with a message like best wishes for the new year or something innocuous. Would that offend you?
That feels appropriate because, again, you can take it too far, but pretty much and maybe this is not true, there may be someone who doesn't follow the Gregorian New Year, mm-hmm. but most Americans, I think, would agree that we're all celebrating the New Year in one way or another. Mm-hmm. So there's different kinds of holidays. Thanksgiving is an American holiday. Probably Native Americans aren't very happy about it. But as a Jew, I'm on board with Thanksgiving. In fact, some believe it's modeled on Sukkot, the Jewish harvest festival. So some American holidays are American holidays, 4th of July, Independence Day. Some American holidays, Christmas, Easter, Good Friday, banks close, it's a Christian holiday because we live in a Christian country. Okay, but don't pretend we don't live in a Christian country. So there's a difference in, you know, the holidays that have come to be known as, you know, everybody's holiday. If we're really sensitive, we know they're not. I'm not sure a Brit would appreciate the 4th of July. I don't know.
Yeah.
But a Native American might not appreciate Thanksgiving. Asking questions is key, you know. Yes.
The Hebrew spoken language and the biblical Hebrew, is it similar, different, or?
Biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew are pretty much the same. The grammar that applies in biblical Hebrew is slightly different. So the way you make past and future in biblical Hebrew is different. It's actually very interesting theologically. To make the past tense in Hebrew, you use the word and, the letter vav, and you make it a future tense. So in order, I just articulated this the other day to someone, and I thought, wow, that's cool. In order to have a past in Hebrew, biblical Hebrew grammar, you need to have the future. I think that's really cool.
Wow.
So God said, let there be light. Well, no, that's because that's future. But, and God said, is vayomer. But yomer is a future form, but the va makes it past. So, but other than that, grammatical thing, biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew are quite similar. Modern Hebrew is spoken in Israel today. I think this is kind of sad. Is becoming very anglicized. So there is a Hebrew word for a computer, a machshev, but they'll say computer, you know, or the creators of the Hebrew language made up a word for a telephone, sach rachok, which means far conversation, but they call it a telephone. So modern Hebrew has lots of anglicized words. This gentleman and then Father Tracy.
So does the Jewish faith allow things like modern prophets and saints to be recognized?
And also, modern prophets and saints.
Yeah. I mean, past biblical times.
Yeah, saints is a completely Christian notion,
right.
So it's just not something we have at all.
Right.
Prophets, the only prophets we consider prophets are the named prophets in the Bible. So for us, even Moses is not a prophet, although in some places he's called that. He's called Moses our teacher. Muhammad is not a prophet to Jews. We recognize that to Muslims, Muhammad is the prophet. We recognize that two Christians, Jesus is, ask two Christians, get three opinions, I suspect. But, so we recognize that other people consider people saints and prophets. We don't consider those same people probably prophets for ourselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was just wondering, I mean, how do you consider, I mean, that prophets stop being, you know, present?
So, we consider kind of prophecy. Classical prophecy was a period of time and that ended, or classical prophetic writing ended at that time and a different kind of writing took over. So we might consider someone wise and smart and prescient, but we wouldn't call him a prophet. Father Tracy.
Rabbi, we Christians should celebrate the revolution we're in at the moment. We're turning our back on the 2,000 years of history, anti-Judaism. Catholic Church now is forbidden to convert Jews. You respect your religion.
You're
traveling the same road of life together. Now, Yom Kippur is the 30th of September this year.
Will you speak into the microphone?
Yom Kippur is the 30th. I've said Catholics are forbidden. Catholic Church recognized Judaism, and by no way are we to try to convert Jews, but to respect our religion. It's part of God's plan. So to walk the road to life together as Jews and Christians. But here's a little gesture that I'm thinking of pushing. I want your opinion on it. Yom Kippur is the 30th of September this year. It varies, as you know, each year. So to show our support, respect for you, and for your welfare, I would like Catholics to fast on Yom Kippur. What do you think?
That's a really interesting question. And for those that don't know, this is Father Tracy, and I'm just learning about all the wonderful things he has done in the world. But you're here as faculty this week, or are you here at Holden?
Teaching staff.
Teaching staff, yeah. I think that's a wonderful gesture. I would discourage it. I might encourage something different to support Jews, maybe offer to take their shift at work so they could go to the synagogue, just like Jews should take over a Christian's shift on Christmas so they can be with their family. Maybe donate the money you might spend on food that day to a food charity. That's backwards. But I think the expectation to fast on Yom Kippur is an expectation for Jews. It's not an expectation for Christians. So just like I shouldn't have a Christmas tree in solidarity with Christians, or
observe Ramadan
or Lent, it's not my holiday. So I think there might be other ways for Catholics and others to honor the people of another religion without adopting their ritual. You might invite Catholics to see if they can come to the synagogue with a Jewish friend and see what we're doing, because then it, you know, the more we see, the more we understand. I'm learning about Lutherans in Vespers. I learned a lot these last 2 days. But not to take, not to appropriate the ritual, I think. It's an interesting question. So there's a difference between trying to honor or learn about or join in with another culture's practices is different than taking them in as my own. The metaphor I often use with, that's Nancy's turn, I went over my time. Last thing, with children of interfaith families, is, or any children, any people, it's like a birthday. When it's my birthday, you give me presents. When it's your birthday, I give you presents. I don't expect presents on your birthday. And it would be wrong of me to have a party on your birthday at my house for me. And I think that's what it's like when we take over someone else's ritual. I can come to celebrate your birthday. I can do something in honor of your birthday, but I shouldn't have a party for me on your birthday. And I think that's a model that we can use. Thank you very much. It's Nancy's turn now. I'm sorry if I went over. I would encourage you to stay for Nancy's session, because Nancy is a very wise woman and has a lot to do.
But go outside, get some fresh air and sun, and...